when scientists were searching for the elusive subatomic Higgs boson particle, the so-called guard particle. Some were afraid that the Large Hadron Collider that would find it would also blow up the universe. Well, that didn't happen, but as it turns out, the news isn't much better. Evidence shows now that the universe we live in is unstable, and at some point, billions of years from now, might just go poof. It'll be wiped out. Joining us now to give us some reason to live is Sean Carroll. He's a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. He's the author of this new book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Hunt for the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. He joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. And Sean, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, the Higgs boson particle described as the final piece of the is described as the final piece of the puzzle. Why is it called that?
Well, it's the final piece to a very specific puzzle, which is the our basic understanding of what we might call ordinary matter. You know, the matter that you're made of, I'm made of, everything in front of you that you see, the sun, the moon, the stars. So there's other stuff out there in the universe. There's dark matter. There's dark energy that is not explained yet. But the Higgs boson was the one missing ingredient to the standard model of particle physics that, as far as we know, explains absolutely everything that you are made of or have ever interacted with directly in your life. So that's kind of a big deal.
Well, and having this knowledge, Sean, affects humankind in the years to come. How?
Well, it affects it because human beings are very curious about how the world works. Mm-hmm. You know, in some sense, this is the culmination of a 2,500-year-old program ever since the ancient Greek atomists said, you know, maybe everything we're made of is a little set of ingredients just organized in different ways. And now we know what those ingredients are. So that's kind of nice. And that's what human beings do. That's what separates us from just surviving.
Yeah, I was really struck by that, that the ancient Greeks, just what you said, had sort of come up with this idea of atoms. How were the ancient Greeks so many years ago able to figure that out?
You know, they were not experimenters at the time. Modern science had not been invented. And they were just trying to use their brains to figure out different ways in which nature might work at a fundamental level. And most of them were not atomists. It was not the most popular school of thought, but there was definitely a particular philosophical strand that thought that they could make the most sense of the world we see in terms of its motions and its interactions. If you think that there's fundamental packets of stuff that just get together and stick together and conglomerate to make the big things that we obviously see.
And so they just were theorizing about all of this. They didn't know anything for sure because they didn't have microscopes and things like that.
That's exactly right. In fact, the idea was more or less put on the back burner until the 19th century. We didn't, you know, it was not the dominant paradigm for the last 2,000 years.
We're talking with Sean Carroll this morning about his new book about why mass exists, the Higgs boson. You know, what is the Higgs boson then, Sean?
Well, the reason it's hard to explain the Higgs boson is because it's not the boson that is all that important, frankly. The boson in modern physics, a particle, is just a little vibration in some field that fills space. Like the photons that you see from a light bulb are vibrations in the electromagnetic field that fills space.
Mm-hmm.
So the important thing is there is a Higgs field that fills space that we move through every day that changes the properties of the particles that we're made of. And this was an idea that came up in the 1960s, and the Higgs boson that we've just now discovered is the evidence that that idea was on the right track, that in fact, even empty space has this field filling it, changing the properties of everything it touches.
And how does the field fill it? What kind of force is at work there?
Well, that's one of the things about modern physics that we, I think, unfortunately don't tell people is that we now think that fields are the fundamental stuff of the universe. The universe is not made of particles at a deep level. When we talk about particles,
yeah,
whether it's electrons or neutrinos or whatever, these are all fields vibrating in different ways. The difference with the Higgs is that it's there even in empty space. There's a big Higgs field even when space is as empty as it can possibly be.
You know, one thing that struck me about this book is just your ability to explain this incredibly complicated stuff in very simple ways, and you're doing so here again this morning, Sean. I mean, that's a trick for a theoretical physicist like yourself. You're at the California Institute of Technology. I'm just wondering, how did you approach writing a book on a topic like this to make it accessible to science clunkheads like me?
Well, you know, writing a book for a broad audience is a different skill than being a scientist. And it takes practice and it takes thinking about it. I'm very, very fortunate to be married to a science writer. So that's a big help. And the trick is to remember what it was like to not know this stuff, you know, to not know the jargon, to have different ideas in your head that are not exactly what modern physics teaches us, and to never forget that it's only for fun and for curiosity that we're doing this. It shouldn't be eating your vegetables. It should be dessert.
Again, our guest, Sean Carroll, he's the author of the new book, The Particle at the End of the Universe. If you want to join our conversation with some questions that might help you understand all this, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. So why has it been called the God particle, Sean?
That was just a little unfortunate bit of marketing genius that was come up with by Nobel Prize-winning physicist Leon Lederman. Back in the 1990s, the United States had begun this project called the Superconducting Supercollider, a giant particle accelerator that would help us find the Higgs boson and other particles. But it was in danger of being canceled, so Lederman and others were trying to put in the sales pitch for why this was really, really important. And they failed. We did cancel the SSC, which is why the Higgs was discovered in Europe, not in the U.S. But to emphasize how crucial a role the Higgs boson plays in our understanding of how the world works, they dubbed it the God particle. And what they didn't quite think through is that people would actually think they were serious and think that discovering the Higgs would tell us something about God, which is about as far away from being true as it is possible to be far away from the truth.
You know, you just mentioned this country was going to build a superconducting supercollider down in Texas, in fact, but we eventually walked away from that idea. How big a setback was that to the physics community when this country walked away from that project?
Well, it was quite devastating to the particle physics community. I mean, there's many other kinds of physics that don't need particle accelerators, but this particular, like I said, 2,500-year-old project of finding the fundamental constituents, it's gotten to the point now where you just can't do it without a gigantic international collaboration with very, very big technology. And everyone was counting on the superconducting supercollider. And when it was canceled, you know, jobs were lost, people were displaced. You know, there are people who have been trying to find the Higgs boson since the mid-1970s. And they thought that they were going to have it because the superconducting supercollider would have been finished earlier and been at a higher energy. And who knows what we're not going to find in Switzerland because we don't have those higher energies available still.
The supercollider that's outside of Geneva, Switzerland, how much did it cost to build and how many countries were involved with that project, Sean?
It's about $9 billion, which everyone should admit is a bunch of money. I don't know how many countries it is, but it's dozens of countries. It's a European project, so the main members are all European. But countries like the United States and China and many other countries contribute in different ways. And this $9 billion is spread out over, you know, many, many years. And so when you divide it into years and divide it into countries, it's a drop in the bucket compared to many, many other things the government spends money on. And it gives us something that is absolutely precious and unique, you know, a new piece of reality that we wouldn't have otherwise had.
And your hope is that projects like this that bring so many nations together, Palestinians working alongside Israelis and everything else, that this could be a hope for the future down the road.
Well, I say in the book that more than one physicist I talked to while writing it volunteered without me asking the idea that if only the United Nations worked as well as CERN, the Particle Accelerator Laboratory, does, then there would be peace on Earth, roughly. And it's because it's a common goal, right? It doesn't matter where you're from. You just want to find the new particles. You want to discover how nature works. And the answer doesn't depend on your philosophical or religious or social beliefs in any way. So, of course, people can work together. That's what you shouldn't be surprised about. It's that the surprising thing is that we have so few examples where people actually do choose to work together in harmony like that.
You know, I want to talk about the day. In fact, it was July 4th, 2012, when the announcement was made about what the first experiments with the collider had begun to show us. But I also want to slow down just for a moment. I've never understood super colliders and how they work. They make things collide into each other at terrific speed. How does that work, and what does that tell us?
That's right. This is a great question. So if you think of a hydrogen atom, it's basically a proton and then an electron zooming around, orbiting the proton. So you take some hydrogen, you zap it with electricity so the electrons get shorn from the protons. And then the protons are these fairly heavy charged particles that you can accelerate using magnetic fields. And so you put them into a beam that goes around in a circle, and you accelerate and accelerate and accelerate until they're moving at 99.999999% the speed of light. So what that means is that every single proton has a tremendous amount of energy. And we're dealing with 100 trillion protons at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you smash them together. And what you're not looking for things that were hiding inside the proton. You're actually looking for an opportunity to bring into existence particles that weren't there before. You're taking advantage of Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared. Energy is proportional to the mass. So if you put a lot of energy into a very tiny area, you can create particles that are massive. The Higgs boson is 125 times more massive than the protons that made it at the Large Hadron Collider.
So why are these things so expensive to build then? $9 billion.
The Large Hadron Collider is really the most complicated machine ever built by human beings. And it's because there's no other way to do this particular experiment. We need to reach these amazing energies. And then once we reach these amazing energies and smash the protons together, we need to do a tremendously delicate operation of seeing what comes out. The Higgs boson itself doesn't just fly out with a little tag on it saying, "Hi, I'm the Higgs boson." In fact, the Higgs boson decays very, very quickly, far too fast for us to ever see it. What we see is what other particles it decays into. So we have to inventory those particles. We have to compare that data against the predictions. And it's just the quintessential scientific experiment. You know, everything is involved, the theory, the data, the technology, the statistics, and it all came together beautifully last July.
This collider in Switzerland, in Geneva, is called CERN. Have you been over there?
I have. Yeah, it's a great thing to visit.
Describe what this looks like and just how massive this particular collider is.
Yeah, it's too massive to really grasp for one person at one time. The actual ring of beam pipes that accelerate the particles is underground, about 300 feet underground, and it goes around in a circle for 17 miles in circumference. 17 miles around underground under the French-Swiss border in Geneva. So at one point when they were digging the tunnel, they had to stop because they ran into the ruins of an ancient Roman village from the year 400. Wow. And they had to bring in the archaeologists to dig in their pottery before the physicists could get back to work. And so you have these huge superconducting magnets that are cooled down to temperatures lower than empty space. And you have these incredibly empty, low-pressure pipes in the middle of them where the protons go down. And they collide in these gigantically huge detectors. The detectors are as large as a good-sized cathedral. And it's great to see pictures of these experiments with people standing next to them dwarfed. And it's also great to think that, you know, you need to build an experiment that big in order to detect particles this small because you need such incredibly high energies to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly. You're saying it so well. Why is the 17-mile tube built 300 feet underground? What's the point of that?
It's cheaper than building it on top of the ground because, you know, there's houses there. You're right in the middle of it's not like an urban area. It's a suburban area. It's the suburbs of Geneva, right? You can see a map because they draw circles on the map where CERN actually is in the Large Hadron Collider, and it goes very, very close to Geneva itself. So to actually tear down people's houses and office buildings to do that would be even more expensive than it really was.
I wonder if you can describe a scene for us that's in your book, July 4th, 2012. This is the opening day of the International Conference on High Energy Physics, and this was the day the world was to learn the first findings from research conducted with the new Geneva Collider. Describe that setting for us, because it's so interesting, and just how much anticipation, Sean, there was at that conference to learn these findings.
Yeah, you know, like I said, we've been looking for the Higgs boson since the mid-1970s. And the last time that we've never discovered a particle just like this. This is a different kind of particle, and it's the last piece of the puzzle. So amazing amounts of anticipation were there. The new collider, the last couple of colliders that had been built had discovered no new particles. But we really thought the Higgs was going to be there. And there was already – there were hints back in December of 2011 that they were finding something. And hopefully it was the Higgs, and hopefully we would find out. And maybe December 2012 or January 2013, they would announce it. But then they're collecting data all along, and you need more and more data to get better and better statistics, better and better confidence that you're on the right track. And when they have this funny, very, very clever way of doing it, that they don't look at the data while they're collecting it, because that would sort of, you know, let them cheat, right? Mm. You know, you want to find something there. So you hide the data from yourself, and you what is called open the box at the end of collecting a whole bunch of it. And when in late June they opened the box for the data they had collected in early 2012, they realized, you know, holy crap, there's something there that is much more noticeable than we thought. So they weren't going to have to wait until December or January. They were going to announce something right away. And there were two different experiments, completely independent from each other, not talking to each other, racing against each other. And there was this conference coming up in Australia, in Melbourne, on July 4th, 2012. And so I really wanted to be there if they were going to announce it. So we were, you know, trying to get hints from the collaborations, like, do I fly to Geneva? Do I fly to Melbourne? This is kind of important. But it was a great scene there. Finally, I flew to Geneva, and you saw these 20-year-old kids who, you know, this was their, you know, introduction to the big time in physics. They were camping out overnight to be in the seminars. And then you saw these 80-year-old physicists who had invented the idea back in the 80s, and they were back in the 1960s. And they were brought in from around the world to be in the audience when the discovery was announced. And, you know, they got choked up. They got emotional. This is something they've been literally waiting most of their lives to see.
How did you react to the news?
Well, it was great. I was there, you know, it's funny, I'm a professional physicist, but I was there on that day in my role as a book writer.
Right.
So I was in the press room, not in the science room. And, you know, journalists are not supposed to clap at press conferences,
yes,
but they couldn't help themselves. You know, everyone broke out into cheers when the announcement was made, because it's not, you know, even though the experiments compete with each other, this is a triumph for all human beings, that we looked into nature's secrets and came back with this amazing treasure. And, you know, it's something that will go down in the history books. 1,000 years from now, we will remember that 2012 was the year we found the Higgs boson.
You know, just one more thing on this, and then we have I want to get to some phone calls here. But the betting line prior to the announcement, was the betting line pretty clear that the Higgs had been discovered and would be announced? Or what was the thinking going into July 4th, 2012?
Well, there were two competing factors at work. One was that we didn't, even though we knew the idea of the Higgs boson, we didn't know how heavy it would be. Mm-hmm. And so the way that the experiments work is they can sort of look for one kind of mass for the Higgs and then look at another kind of mass, then look at another kind of mass and hope eventually they home in on it. And most of the possible places that the Higgs boson could have been, we had already looked and we had not found it there. So on the one hand, you think, well, good, we know where it must be. We've ruled everything else out and we're going to look at this final location in mass. But the other part of you is saying, you know, there's this tiny little part in the back of your head that is going, maybe it's just not there. Maybe there's something much more dramatic and we'll be surprised. And it's a no-lose situation, because either you triumphantly confirm these ideas from the 1960s and you know that you're on the right track, or you learn something new and surprising and then you can get back to the drawing board and figure out what's really going on.
Our guest is Sean Carroll. He's the author of the new book, The Particle at the End of the Universe. He speaks tomorrow evening at 7 at the Linda Hall Library adjacent to the UMKC campus. The library has reached its seating capacity, and even e-tickets are no longer available for tomorrow night's event. But we have Sean Carroll with us right now. Again, our number 816-235-2888 and our email address update@kcur.org. David from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Well, I guess my question would be, now that we've found the Higgs boson, what is the next step in finding out what the developmental of matter is? I mean, we just keep breaking it down and breaking it down, but what are we looking for next?
What's the next step, Sean?
Good. This is the right question to ask because, the Higgs boson is not going to go away, just like the idea of atoms has not gone away, but we just understand better what they're made out of. We do certainly want to keep pushing forward. The Large Hadron Collider has been online for about 4 years, but we're hoping it will run for 40 years. So we're going to keep looking for new stuff. And we have very, very good reason to believe that new stuff is out there. Like I said, there's dark matter and dark energy in the universe. This ordinary matter of which you and I are made, and of which we are very proud to now have a complete theory, makes up 4% of the stuff in the universe. So there's no end of full employment for physicists, both theorists trying to figure things out and experimentalists trying to look for more new things.
David, I hope that helps. Joe from Lenexa. Joe, you're on with Sean Carroll. Good morning.
Hi, Sean. You've described this as the greatest invention that man's ever developed, and $90 billion. And what I'm wondering is, What will this discovery create for us? Will it solve cancer? Will it enable us to travel at interstellar speeds? Now that we've found this, how is it going to benefit mankind directly?
Yeah, I'm not sure about cancer, Sean, but maybe the interstellar speed thing might be something worth talking about. Go ahead.
Yeah, cancer is more likely, to be honest. But I should point out that just a tiny correction, $9 billion, not 90. No one would ever give us $90 billion dollars to do anything. But the smart money is that within our lifetimes, the Higgs boson itself will lead to absolutely no new technological advancements. Hmm. Remember, it decays away very quickly. And by very quickly, I mean one zeptosecond, which is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a second. So it's not going to help us cure cancer. It's not going to make a better iPhone, jetpack, teleportation machine, or anything like that. Now, having said that, the search for the Higgs boson does give us new technology. It gives us new superconducting technology, new computer technology, new detector technology. And studies have been done that show that every dollar you put into fundamental research of this form comes back much more than a dollar back into the economy. The obvious example is the World Wide Web was invented at CERN by particle physicists learning how to share their data. So the reason we look for the Higgs is not because of technology, it's just curiosity. But what we get out of that is this wonderful spinoff of all sorts of new technologies.
Hmm. Joe, thank you for the good call. Let's go to Stacy from Olathe. Stacy, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Love this conversation. And I'm kind of a science novice, so I'm going to try to get through this question. Okay, I understand why you need to build something so large to find something so small.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering why the particles are so rare. Is it they're so rare because if they were created in the Big Bang, they are just so far away from us now, so there's only a few left? Or is it that we didn't know what we were looking for necessarily? Like, why? I guess my question is, why has it taken so long? And it may feed into the dark matter. Like, we just haven't figured out how to find dark matter yet. I guess it's all around us. We just haven't figured out how to detect it. So I guess that's the question. Why are they so hard to find?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it goes back to just how particles interact with each other. If you have one heavy particle that can interact with light particles, then that heavy particle is going to want to decay. It's going to want to turn into those light particles. The neutron, which is crucial to ordinary matter, if it's all by itself out there in the wild, it lasts for a few minutes, and then it decays into a proton, an electron, a neutrino. So the Higgs boson, likewise, it decays very quickly. The top quark, the tau lepton, all these particles that we've discovered in experiments, they were created in the Big Bang, and they just dissolved. They turned into other particles very, very quickly. The dark matter is a different kind of particle. We don't know exactly what it is. In fact, literally yesterday, there was a talk in Denver at the meeting of the American Physical Society that said there's an experiment that had little tiny hints that maybe we've actually seen the shadows of dark matter in our experimental detectors. Nowhere near enough to be certain of anything, but that is an experiment that is ongoing. We'd like to find that because somehow this dark matter particle that we think is all around us, going through your body right now, but just not interacting, not easily noticeable. So we have to push ourselves to our technological limits to put a finger on this stuff that makes up most of the matter in the universe.
Stacy, thank you. We're talking this morning about the Higgs boson, essentially the fundamental particle which gives all other fundamental particles the very property we call mass. You start this book, Sean, by talking about a woman named Joanne Hewitt. Who is she, and why did you start things off with her?
Well, Joanne is a theoretical particle physicist mm-hmm. who I know, and she just serves the illustrative purpose because I wanted to make it a human story. I wanted to convince people that, you know, there are all of these very, very smart, very, very hardworking, very, very dedicated professional physicists who had literally dedicated their lives to doing this. If you're, you know, under the age of 60 or so forth, then all your professional life, we have been looking for the Higgs boson. If you're a physicist, and we didn't know for sure that it would be there, right? And Joanne works on the Higgs boson. She constructs models of it, helps us find it by making predictions for what it will look like. And she was also a few years ago diagnosed with breast cancer, mm-hmm. had to fight through that. And you know, she told me at one point she was laying on her back in pain during the chemotherapy sessions in her house, and thinking to herself, I can't die before we find the Higgs boson. And it's just one tiny little example, and I give others in the book, of how incredibly dedicated these people are to what seems like very abstract stuff. But the search for what we're made of and how we work and how the universe behaves is something that has a very, very strong grip on the human imagination. And we don't need to be taught that that's important. We need to remember that that's important.
Are there needs for other super colliders down the road? Now that we've discovered the Higgs, Sean, is there now a sense that we need to do X, Y, and Z to continue our discoveries?
Well, there's absolutely – it would be very useful to our understanding of particle physics and how nature works to have a next-generation collider. There are plans on the drawing board. Like I said, you can't do it on the cheap. You know, for half the money of the LHC, you would have found zero Higgs bosons, not half as many. So you need a giant commitment. You need international cooperation. The United States is not very good at international cooperation. We're good at starting projects and then pulling the plug at the last minute. So countries like Japan and Switzerland and China have put forward serious proposals to be the host of the next collider, and we'll have to see what happens.
Sean Carroll is the author of The Particle at the End of the Universe. He's a Caltech theoretical physicist. I sure enjoyed having you, Sean. Thanks so much for joining us today, and thanks for explaining it in a way that even I could sort of hang on to here a little bit.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Again, that's Sean Carroll. He'll speak Tuesday evening at a sold-out event at the Linda Hall Library. You can find more information on all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.